This is The End User, episode 174, for Tuesday, June 10th, the Aereo Rube Goldberg Machine. Hello, and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Moore. So Chris, last week was like the Apple week. And then this week we've got a big Microsoft week. And it's all pretty much Xbox news because they had a big announcement today at the kickoff of the E3 game conference.
Yes, well, we're going to get a lot of other news coming out. You know, Sony's press announcement is right now as we are recording this, so we'll have to get to that next week. But yeah, what we had earlier today was the announcement from Microsoft and what they're up to with the Xbox. And I'm thankful that, while I'm not the biggest gamer in the world, I'm thankful that they've really focused on games. And that seems to be the message they're trying to drive home is, you know, last time we looked around and last time we talked about it, they were talking about Kinect and they were talking about all kinds of things. And around rolls E3 and they're talking all about games. And that makes a lot of sense. So the other shoe has dropped for all the people who were worried that they were only going after the living room and ditching their kind of mainstay gaming audience. That obviously isn't true. And here we see the other shoe drop at E3. So some pretty good gaming stuff this week.
All right, so I haven't followed along. What are the new games that they've been talking about?
So they had a very long keynote, and they had a lot of information in there. And it's too much for us to cover here, particularly with neither of us being the world's biggest gamers. But I wanted to kind of go over the highlights of the ones that I thought were going to be the more popular ones. So I know our fellow The DigitalMediaZone.com podcaster Josh is going to be excited because they showed off a little bit of Forza Horizon 2. So this is a game that's going to be released for the Xbox One and the 360, and we're looking at September 30th of this year. And this is going to be a common theme amongst a lot of these new games. This is now when we are starting to see Xbox One games come out that are 1080p. And 30 frames per second. They're really starting to try and push the hardware a little further.
Yeah, cool. I mean, that's the whole point of these next generation
Yes.
of consoles, right? They're supposed to max out the capabilities of your TV.
Yes, absolutely. So it's definitely a good thing to see that come out with a lot of the games that they were talking about at E3. So, yes, Forza, as you probably already know, is a racing game, and it's like a hyper-realistic kind of game. It's going to be pretty cool, and I'm sure what you can do is listen to Entertainment 2.0, and they will talk a whole lot more about not only Forza, but a lot of this Xbox news. But in particular, I'm sure they will devote at least an hour and a half to Forza alone, so that's good. So the other one that kind of caught my attention was Sunset Overdrive. Have you heard of this one?
I have not.
It's a little different. It's a little different. It's not one that is kind of in the typical, you know, series of releases like Forza and like Halo and all these guys. So they've got a kind of unique game engine going. It's a free world game where you can roam around this little world and achieve missions together. And it's kind of like if you took all of the gangster activity out of Grand Theft Auto and you inserted wacky superheroes. So they encourage encourage you in this game to kind of jump around and like ride on like zip lines and stuff like that, and you know, kind of fly around this universe and blow stuff up, and it looked like a lot of fun from the trailers that I was able to see.
It sounds fun from your description.
So again, this is a fall release. We're looking at October 28th for the first word on that one.
Okay, cool. Any other big name games you want to talk about? I'm sure there's a new Halo, right?
Yes, there's always a new Halo, Taylor. Always, always, always more Halo.
So tomorrow there will be more Halo.
No, so what we're looking at is Halo 5 Guardians, and they're saying that is going to be in beta. And I saw some conflicting dates, so I'm not quite sure exactly what date they said. So what all of the sources I read could agree on was December. So we're going to have a beta in December that will last about a month, and then we're going to see it actually be released sometime in fall of 2015. So they brought out a new trailer, and other than that, I didn't see a lot of information about it. But it's there, and it's
wow. So yeah, this is a big development process if they're announcing it now and not releasing it until more than a year from now.
Yeah, and I don't know how the beta process is going to go. You know, it's hard to say how open that's going to be. You know, maybe it's one of these, I can't imagine it would be, but maybe it's going to be a little bit more open than game releases usually are. But I don't know. Hard to say. We don't know.
So I did read that in the interim, they're going to be developing a Master Chief collection which will include the first four Halo games.
Yes. So it's kind of like a remaster, you know, like the Star Wars digital remaster kind of deal, where they're taking all of the old games and they're bringing them kind of up to spec with more modern hardware and re-releasing them. So that'll be kind of neat.
But even that doesn't come out until November.
Yeah, no. So we got a little ways to wait for a lot of these games. And again, you know, that's what E3 is for. It's the kind of advance of all of the games coming out. So one of my favorite games, and this is one that I actually have played in the past, unlike Sunset Overdrive and Forza, Assassin's Creed Unity is going to be coming out. And what's kind of cool about that is they're coming out for the Xbox One, the PS4, and PC, and they're going to have a release date of October 28th. So they're coming down the pipeline too. And it's an interesting article from Kotaku today about the Assassin's Creed launch, and they're kind of saying that this is the game that you can look at for modern gaming consoles, you know, living up to their hardware. And they show a bunch of clips, you know, real gameplay clips, and Microsoft did in their demo of, you know, somebody standing up on stage with a controller playing the thing, and he's wandering through huge crowds of people, and you know, the ability to render, the amount of detail, is really taking advantage of the new class of hardware that we've gotten in a way that I don't think any other game that I've seen has done.
Cool. I will be just across different platforms if they are going to be on PS4, Xbox One, and PC all at the same time.
Yeah, and PC. And, you know, there was a version for my Windows phone. But that one's not going to have the new graphics, I can tell you right now.
Probably not.
So, last one up here, and this is a game I used to play all the time. This is Rainbow Six. Do you remember Rainbow Six?
Yeah, the Tom Clancy series.
Yeah, so apparently they're finally going to re-release this game, and they've just pretty much released a trailer with a little gameplay demo, a little multiplayer gameplay. And from what I can see, it looks pretty cool. It is definitely a new era of this kind of SWAT game that I don't feel like we haven't seen much of for a long time. That used to be a huge category of games, and I feel like it's not around much anymore.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I feel like Battlefield is still around. And wasn't Splinter Cell split off of Rainbow Six?
Yes.
So
I'm not sure if it wasn't officially, but it was in the same category at the same time.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. So the new Rainbow Six, is that going to be cross-platform or just for the Xbox?
So I'm not sure we know yet. From what I've seen, it's just the trailer. They're just saying this is going to exist. And I guess you have to be leery sometimes with this kind of thing. But it looked like, you know, it didn't look like a render. This was kind of a gameplay concept. So, you know, I don't think we have that level of detail yet, but they're at least working on it. So hopefully it doesn't fall by the wayside like Duke Nukem Forever or something.
Sure, okay, that's pretty cool. And didn't Duke Nukem Forever eventually come out?
It did eventually come out. It just took I forget how long it took, but it was a long time.
A very, very long time, yes.
All right, well, I guess that's all we have for E3 for the moment. Like I said, Sony is doing their live announcement as we are recording the podcast, so we're going to have to follow up a little bit more with PlayStation News next week as we get some of the details. And E3 continues on, so we'll follow up next week with that. But for now, we can move into some Intel news. What's going on with their new line of processors here?
Yeah, so at another big conference trade show that happened last week, we spent all week talking about WWDC, hosted by Apple in San Francisco. But another one that was going on is called Computex. And there were some big announcements that came out of that one, too. And I just want to focus on one in particular. Intel gave us some more information about their next generation of processors, codenamed Broadwell. These are going to be coming out in late 2014 to 2015. And they are the new 14 nanometer transistor production process. So absolutely the smallest, most complex transistor chips that have ever been created. And this one has actually taken them a little bit longer to perfect. Usually they would have it out by now. And we are starting to reach the limit of Moore's law that says that the number of transistors on a chip can double every 18 months. It's taken a little bit longer for them to get this product to market, but their latest announcement was really interesting because they showed basically a tablet that's thinner than the iPad Air and is running a full power Intel Core series processor. They're calling it the Core M. It's ultra low power. But I guess the interesting thing is that it doesn't need a fan. This is a...
Yeah, that's a big deal.
This is a full-power computer processor where they've managed to eliminate the necessity of a processor fan. And indeed, the fan for the entire device, since they managed to fit it into both a hybrid laptop prototype and a tablet prototype with no fan in the computer at all.
Yeah, that's definitely a shift for Intel. I'm not used to seeing them play in the low power space compared to ARM.
It's a shift in the entire computer industry, or yes, at least it has the makings of it. Because the last time a full powered 86 architecture computer didn't have a processor fan on it was in like 1993. So they had tower boxes that had case fans in them, but they had passive cooling on the processor itself. And so we've come a long way, but I'm wondering, Chris, you know, was the computer with a fan in it, is this just a, you know, a 20 or 30 year anomaly? Will we eventually go back to these fanless computers and make the computers that we grew up with, you and I, a relic of the past?
Well, yeah, I think naturally you move away from complexity, right? You move away from complexity for the device maker. You know, of course, the chip gets more complex, but if you tell a device maker they don't have to have a fan, the space competition inside of the device is so big that, you know, they're going to say, okay, if I don't have to have a fan, then it's out. You know, I can put a Bluetooth radio in there now. And, you know, I can make it thinner now. So if they really have broken the heat barrier in a way that you can use a real Intel processor and not have a fan on it, then, yeah, I think it's going to go away. Again, short of, this is always the case, but short of really, really high-end video editing, you know, that kind of thing, something that's really, really intense. But for kind of the everyday device, I guess Intel may be trying to get back into the, or not back, but they're trying to break into the tablet market in a way that they really haven't up to yet.
Right, because they couldn't. They didn't have that capability. Yeah. They tried creating mobile processors and they were not getting the sales and the performance that they expected out of it, but their main computer processor architecture has always been really solid, but just needed a fan any way you cut it. And so now they've gotten it to this point for the first time in 20 years where it no longer requires a fan, where it's getting the amount of performance that we're seeing from modern desktops and laptops but you can run it without a fan again. It's a remarkable sea change, I think, and no one's making a big deal of
it. Yeah, it's pretty quiet out there about this, with all of the E3 and the Apple announcement. Not much about this, but what I did have just to throw a knife into your theory. I had an Atom motherboard that was fanless, but you really needed a case fan to run that. That was my old home theater PC. That thing didn't have a fan.
Sure, but Atom is the market segment that I'm talking about. They were trying to not necessarily create something that was mobile, but to create something that was low power enough that you could eliminate the fan. That was the goal of Atom, was to eliminate the fan.
Right.
This is more like a full-featured high-power computer that eliminates the fan just as a matter of course. They didn't have to sacrifice anything. I mean, because I remember that Atom PC that you had, you were a little disappointed. It was pretty underpowered.
Yeah, it really choked on 1080p video when you didn't have graphics acceleration. So when you had the graphics acceleration kick in, it was fine for 1080p video. But when you didn't, it did not do so well.
And that's something that I think a lot of ARM chips still struggle with. But it's something that Intel's modern core processors have never had any problem.
Yeah, very true. They've always been the powerful workhorse.
Well, that was about all that Intel was announced. They gave a few more details on some of the other chips that they will be coming out. This is only one of several classes of chipsets that they will eventually release with Broadwell. But we've heard about and talked about those before, and we pretty much know everything that is going to be coming aside from this new Intel Core M family, which is the fanless version.
All right. Well, with that, let's get into the afterburners. You can securely fasten your seatbelt before we get going and perhaps make yourself a gin fizz.
I'll wait till after we turn the afterburners back off to make the gin fizz. But my seatbelt is on, so we can go right back to the Microsoft stories for a bit.
All right. So Microsoft has begun selling the Xbox One with no Kinect. It's going to be $400 at retail. So that's a little bit of a reversal from what we saw before. And I think it's going to help their market adoption to sell it at a cheaper price without the Kinect. So it's definitely a good option to see, particularly as we have all of the games coming out of E3.
You could also buy an Xbox One controller with no Xbox, because now you can connect it via wires or wirelessly to a Windows PC. The drivers have just been made available by Major Nelson Herb.
Yeah, so that's pretty neat. Remember, we talked about Assassin's Creed being available for PC, PS4, and Xbox One. So you could play Assassin's Creed on your PC with an Xbox One controller. That is super cool.
Now, you can buy the Xbox One without a Kinect. You can buy the controller without an Xbox One. And now you can also buy a Kinect without the Xbox or the controller, because they will start shipping a version of the Kinect that works with Windows.
Yeah, and I feel like it's mostly for developers. You know, we haven't seen any kind of real use cases for a Kinect for Windows, but pretty cool stuff to see.
So if you don't have an Xbox to Kinect, an Xbox controller, or a Windows PC, you can get one update from Microsoft this week, and that is Skype for iOS and iPhone and iPad. And it's a great redesign. It looks really good. And my only problem so far is that it automatically enabled background calling on my iPad.
Ooh.
So I just realized that today when you called me, Chris.
Was it on your iPad?
Yeah, so it rang. Skype rang on my computer and my iPad simultaneously and didn't turn off when I answered the call from you on my computer. So I'm going to have to go ahead and turn that off after the show.
Yeah, that makes sense. I get a little confused because of the I have the Metro Skype application. I have the desktop Skype application. So far, they've been pretty good about not interacting.
Yeah, so but I do really love the update of the iOS app. It's great. I hardly use it, but I do like it a lot. It looks good.
So Apple has snuck a secret feature into iOS 8, and that is kind of interesting from a security perspective. They are now starting to randomize the MAC address that your phone announces to Wi-Fi hotspots. So what some retailers have done, and we've talked about this before on the show, is they track the MAC address that their Wi-Fi hotspots are receiving to track their customers around the store, because your phone just kind of broadcasts a unique identifier, the MAC address, out into the air, and whenever you hit various routers, they can kind of tell and triangulate where you are located in the store. Now, they don't know that you're Taylor Marr, for example, but they do know that you were a single customer in the store doing whatever you were doing, and obviously, there's some privacy concerns with that, and if you were concerned about that, iOS is going to randomize the MAC address that they broadcast from now on, in as of iOS 8. So that seemed like a pretty small but very interesting feature coming in iOS 8. There's a lot of features that we haven't talked about on the show that are going to kind of creep in as we go over time here.
Yeah, what this basically means to me is it's a huge privacy win for anybody who has... Yes. On iOS device, it's now more difficult to track someone using their phone, basically. You used to be able to, if you could identify the MAC address of someone's iPhone or iPad, you could track them anytime you could identify that MAC address. So if the MAC address changes, which is how it's going to work now, then you can't track a person that way, which was one of the easiest ways to do it up until this point.
Yeah, and it also avoids a whole class of, you know, there was like MAC address spoofing and all kinds of stuff just because the MAC address was static, and that was a problem. There's a whole class of security concerns.
Yeah, and we will come back to that later in the show. We will be mentioning static MAC addresses in this week's kicker.
All right, let's finish off the afterburner first. You can now stream... play movies from the Google Play Store and TV shows offline on Chromebooks. This is not something that Chromebooks have been able to do up until now, and it's definitely good to see that platform, you know, gain a little bit of maturity, because it's definitely something that you want. You want to be able to take your Chromebook on an airplane and watch a movie. So,
yeah, if you had already bought into the Google ecosystem enough that you have a Chromebook, you should definitely be able to access their built-in content store.
Yeah, it just... kind of makes sense. And you have to imagine that this was inevitable to happen at some point. And now it's going to happen. So that's definitely a good thing to see the Chromebooks kind of grow up a little bit. So speaking of the Google ecosystem, I thought this was really cool. Aereo is adding support for Chromecast to its Android app. So you're going to be able to take Aereo's dime-sized antenna array and get your local broadcast stations over the internet into your Android phone, and then cast them to the TV. This is the kind of Rube Goldberg machine that makes that kind of functionality be possible. But that's really, really compelling. That's really cool.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And it's a little strange that you're using your Android phone to transmit broadcast television to your television.
Yeah, you're bathing in the free television going around you in the air, and yet it's coming through your Chromecast.
Well, but then you also have access to cloud DVR recordings and
yes,
pause,
yeah,
and rewind and fast forward. So that's pretty cool. And I have yet to meet that many people who are using Chromecast as their primary input on their TV, but I suspect we'll be seeing more and more.
Yes, I think we will undoubtedly be seeing more.
So Sony is finally shipping their smart band activity tracker. It's $99. It's now available in the US. They announced it back at CES in January. And it is comparable to the Jawbone UP24 and the Fitbit Flex, but it only works with Android devices.
Yeah, the Jawbone Up 24. So the... I thought this was interesting because we saw this device. We were unsure if it would make it to the market in CES earlier in the year in January, and here it is. It's actually on the market. So many devices don't make it past CES, and this is one that has made it. So good to see another competitor in that kind of fitness band category. So I thought that was cool.
All right, well, that's for the afterburners. Let's turn them off and give me 2 minutes, Chris, while I go make a... I'm going to make a slow gin fizz this time.
Okay, that works. So does that make that takes exactly 120 seconds?
No, it's a pouring a Guinness takes exactly 119.5 seconds. a gin fizz is generally just around the 2 minute mark. You've got to shake the egg whites with ice for a while.
Okay, so it's a plus or minus 10 second situation.
Yep.
Okay. Okay. Well,
it depends on how hard you shake.
Well, so let's get into the end user stories. We've got a interesting one up front here. It's the LG G3 has been out for reviews, and it looks like, you know, this is the best LG phone we've seen yet, and it is a real modern Android smartphone competitor that can hang with the rest of them. What is a little interesting, I guess, is that it's going the same trend as the rest of the Android industry and becoming gigantic. It's 5.5 inches. So they're upping the camera to 13 megapixels. It's going to be able to shoot 4K video, which is kind of cool. I'm not sure you need all of that in a little phone.
Yeah, that's my problem with it. Obviously, there's a lot to like about it.
Yes.
So for one thing, it looks fantastic.
Yeah, it's pretty gorgeous looking.
They've nailed a minimal screen focused design. Just from the front of it, it's all screen. It looks great, and they have this metallic skin that they're advertising. I'm not sure what it is since I haven't been able to get my hands on it or see it in person. But everything looks great on here. But the problem, I think, is they've made this great phone that has these absurdly strong specs that aren't necessarily what people want. So take this 5.5-inch display for starters. It is quad HD. It is 2560 by 1440. That's the resolution. That would be the resolution of a 27-inch desktop screen or the 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro. Now, that MacBook Pro, it's called the Retina MacBook Pro because it's the highest resolution that your eyes can see from a normal viewing distance. It's beyond that. It's the Retina limit of what average eyes can see. So that's for a 13-inch screen, and they've taken the same resolution and brought it into a 5.5-inch screen. It's just way more pixels than one could ever need on a phone. So the fact that they were able to build that into a phone is technically extremely impressive. And the fact that they were able to give that phone good battery life is twice as impressive. This is a well-executed piece of technology that completely fails to capture the features that people are actually looking for.
Yeah, you know,
not completely, but it misses the point.
I feel like this just kind of happens. Like, we've seen it with the Pono player we talked about. That thing is completely, just has too much quality, and you just, there's no way anybody can tell a difference, even in perfect conditions. There's just no way that anyone can tell a difference. And yet there's this subset of the market that is really invested in their hi-fi music that will, you know, love that device. And to them, when they listen to it, they hear a difference, even though it's not really possible because, you know, they're so invested in it. But I feel like we're seeing the same kind of thing here where you say, well, you know, more is clearly better, so we're going to stick that screen on a phone that's 5.5 inches. And I feel like it happens to any market over time, and that's what we're seeing here too.
Well, I would love to see the market eventually speak back and say, hey, by the way, this is not what we're looking for. This is not necessary. So another aspect of that, and it's not quite as clear cut, is this this ability to shoot 4K video. And I have to say, okay, that's pretty cool. And especially if you have a 4K TV or monitor that you just got and you're looking to show it off, the fact that you can fill that up with one-to-one resolution video from your phone, that's fantastic. Most people don't have that, and most people won't be able to see that kind of video. What I would like to see instead is a better image sensor that just has better backsiding illumination, or a hybrid IR filter like Apple is including in their latest phones, or optical image stabilization, which this probably has. I don't even know. It's lost in the sea of features included in this phone.
Yeah, to you and HTC, Taylor. HTC famously has a lower res camera on their devices because they say, but it doesn't matter. We'll make a better sensor.
Well, Apple has been making the same argument for their last few phones.
Yep, yep. All I can say is that any smartphone you get in 2014 will take absolutely gorgeous photos. That's become a reality that we just live in now. So I think that's pretty cool for, you know, everyone who's getting these devices.
Some more gorgeous than others, Chris.
All right, well, shall we move into a bit of a Taylor Marr patent-pending net neutrality rant?
Sure. My net neutrality rant this week, again, I'm sorry to have to do this every week, but the news keeps coming, and it keeps making me so mad. It's infuriating, and it's important, and I just want everybody to hear it. So for everyone who hears me and agrees with me, I'm really sorry, but I think you're going to get a kick out of some of these stories this week, especially if you are not already familiar. So the first piece of it has to do with getting the United States wired and online with fiber optic internet service. And Chris, you found a great story from Vice about all of the dark fiber that's out there that the internet companies refuse to use and are paying money to keep the government from forcing them to use.
Yeah, it's funny what happened.
It's just there.
What happened was the during the dot-com bubble, once that burst, there was just a bunch of internet infrastructure just kind of sitting there in the ground, and nobody ended up lighting it up. And now some of the telecom lobby is hoping that that remains the case, it seems.
So one of the clearest examples given in this article is Washington, D.C., where we both live.
Yes.
And there exists a 100 gigabit per second fiber optic network that is currently only available to well-connected nonprofit organizations in the city's core. And the city renegotiated with Comcast in 1999 and relented to allow Comcast to use that network only as the federal government saw fit and not to any of the residents of the city. And the city agreed to that, to those demands, because Comcast, I guess, threatened to pull out of the city entirely.
Yeah, because they're the huge majority of the cable infrastructure here.
Seems like bad negotiating skills on the part of Washington, D.C., but I'm
probably
not sure.
A little bit of
I
both.
Wasn't there. I was 14. but the same or similar stories are true in hundreds of cities across the U.S. And the article even has a nice little map of just disconnected fiber optic cables.
Yeah, there's a ton of infrastructure that's just sitting there, and maybe it's out of a lot of it is probably not in good repair at this point in time, but there's the physical wiring in the ground is basically there to use, but it does take some upfront investment from somebody to kind of, you know, tap into it, dig it up, and make it usable again.
Yeah, and obviously that requires an investment in infrastructure, but it's a necessary investment. The United States is way behind huge parts of the world in providing fast, cheap, reliable internet service. And it's just sitting there. It's wasted capital at this point. And yes, more capital is required to use it, but that is going to be true regardless of the state of our telecommunications network.
You think that they would want to dig it up and get more capacity so that their customers are happier. But that's just not, you know, I'm sure at some level they want their customers to be happier, but they're really not making it easy for us to make an argument for that. I know it's like a dog pile now and everybody's piling on to these guys, but it's really, you know, they just need more competition, and whatever we can do from a governmental standpoint to make that happen, I think we should do. And you know, whether or not that means deregulating to encourage competition or regulating to discourage monopoly, I think we have to find something that makes sense. And I don't think we quite know what that is.
But
and
what if it's not about regulation or deregulation,
yeah,
or dogpiling or public shaming? What if it's just about making a deal? You know, like Washington, D.C. had the chance to do with Comcast in 1999, and they failed to make a deal that could provide next generation internet services to the District of Columbia. So what if that deal had gone better?
Yeah,
would
very
that
true.
Be all it takes? Well, unfortunately, we know the answer to that, and the answer is no. And that leads me to my next story. So in 2008, the New York City Department of Information Technology and Telecommunications made a deal, a very good deal with Verizon, saying that they worked out a way to bring Fios fiber optic networks to all of New York City by June 30th, 2014. That is rapidly approaching, and Verizon is now saying that they are well behind schedule. And they are blaming Hurricane Sandy. The problem is that in April of last year, after Hurricane Sandy, they claimed to be ahead of schedule in their rollout for fiber optics throughout the entire city.
So if nothing else, they're not very good at messaging, are they?
I don't know what they're not good at, aside from... building out their own fiber network, but they have proven that making good deals that are in both company and public interest, because it's not like they would be required to provide any of these services for free. They made a deal to build out their network, to offer it at market rate to most, not even all, of the city. And they are failing to do that in the time that they agreed upon. And maybe they'll get their act together, and they are saying that they do plan to continue their rollout to the point where they get to close to 100% of the city of New York. And so that's good, but it's still another example of internet companies talking out of both sides of their mouth.
Yeah.
So I'm not the only one who's fed up with it, Chris. Did you hear about this?
Yes, Netflix. I have had a bowl of popcorn in my lap just watching this back and forth between Verizon and Netflix. What's happening? What's the latest?
Well, this is all over the past week, so let's start at the beginning. Netflix started giving...
A long time ago in a galaxy far away.
Well, a week ago, in a home just like yours, Netflix started giving provider-specific... error messages when people got buffering on their Netflix feeds. So the buffering feed would say, for example, the Verizon network is too crowded right now. We're downgrading your video or adjusting your video for smoother playback. So it's interesting that Netflix, especially with Verizon, remember Netflix and Verizon and Comcast and Netflix inked deals where Netflix agreed to pay them money to optimize the streaming performance on each of their networks. Now, Comcast has the data usage statistics and has been able to show concretely that their performance on Comcast and Verizon networks had been dropping for months before this deal was made, and on Comcast started to go up immediately afterwards. Now they've released the statistics for the Verizon network and found that the network continued to get worse. The performance over the Verizon network got worse. So Netflix decided to release this information to back up their public shaming of Verizon. And Verizon simply tried to issue a cease and desist, threatening a lawsuit unless they immediately stopped sending these notices. And so Netflix said, no, look, we have the data. We can prove that the Verizon network is at fault here. And so Verizon just said, no, we are not going to change these messages.
Yeah, so that is not encouraging. Given, again, any one of these things would be, you know, bad, but we probably wouldn't even talk about it if it were just any one issue that we've brought up. But all of these things together are pretty damning for companies that just underserve their customers. That's the bottom line of it, is that, you know, you can make all of the net neutrality and anti-net neutrality arguments that you want. You can talk about markets and free markets. But what we're seeing is monopolistic and duopolistic companies underserving their customers. And the question is, how do we get around that? And I don't think we have an answer. And I really don't think what the FCC is doing is the correct answer either.
You're absolutely right about that. Here is my optimistic take on a solution for this. The solution has to come with fair regulations based on the way the internet has worked so far and the way that we understand to create and maintain a free internet, which is based on the principles of net neutrality. And if you can maintain the principles of net neutrality and fair market competition, which the cable companies are working systematically and quickly to completely dismantle, if you can maintain those two basic principles in regulations and in policy, then the market should be able to push the companies responsible for these services in a direction that moves towards a fair, fairly priced, good service in the long term. And so we've talked about why there doesn't appear to be free market competition in the United States and how they are currently in the process of dismantling net neutrality as it applies to them and their pocketbooks. But last week on an HBO show called Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, he spent a 13-minute segment on his show breaking down what we've been talking about for months and easily putting it into hilarious but true bullet points about what you need to know about what these companies are doing, and pointing out that nobody cares because it's so inherently boring to actually try to talk about the details.
Yes, yeah.
Which we've been futilely doing.
Yes, well, I know there's our audience is probably a little more interested than most people in general would be about the details. And, you know, there's shows like This Week in Law for that kind of argument to happen. And they had a good segment on that show. So there are places where they get more into the technical lawyer kind of things. And, you know, we're not quite going there.
Yeah, sure. We try to stick to the fence between John Oliver making fun of people on television and those guys who are really digging into the actual details of it and the legal precedents for what's being done and what can be done and what's right and what's wrong. And all of that is really important. But John Oliver ended his segment by pointing out that the FCC had just begun an open comment period, which we had discussed on the show before.
Yes, yes.
And made a call to action of internet comment trolls, saying, look, here's your chance. Direct your angry, evil comment trolling tendencies.
Yeah, people of 4chan, unite.
Yeah, towards a source of good by calling the FCC out on its complacency in this behavior, in the dismantling of net neutrality, and indeed in some forms of market competition. And to an extent, it worked. They were able to crash the FCC site through wholly ingenuous use of comments through the FCC comment system. That
so
is to say,
I guess the FCC needs to pay Verizon and Comcast to you know, get some kind of caching servers in the in their networks.
I'm sure they'll have preferential treatment. They'll never have to pay for it.
Now they'll probably just, you know, this happened once and they probably just won't worry about it.
Yeah, probably not. But hey, we could keep trying. We could keep trying to crash the site. It's pretty much the last legal option we have left.
Although you have to be careful about that, because it's fine if you are crashing the site just because of a lot of humans went there. That's one thing, and that's kind of funny. But DDoS attacks where robots attack websites, that is in fact illegal and can be... It is illegal.
That is a good point. We are not suggesting or condoning that anyone attempt to purposefully crash the FCC site. We are just saying go and try to submit as many reasonable, well thought out comments as possible. Or, you know, do what John Oliver said.
Right. All right. Well, enough of this net neutrality talk. Let's get into some uses for the internet that we do have today. And let's get into the tip of the week. You have an iCloud tip of the week for us. What's going on here?
I do. Yeah. This has to do specifically with iCloud reminders lists. And this is a feature that I've known about for a while, but I hardly ever get to use because you can share iCloud reminders lists with other people using their iCloud's accounts. And it's something that I wish people would know about and how easy it is to do because shared lists can be incredibly useful. Grocery lists for any number of households or events or group projects or chores or anything that you do with a group of people, as long as they all have iCloud accounts, it's really easy. And so Lifehacker has a link to a blog post in Make Tech Easier on how to easily do this. And I always try to tell people about this. And it's iCloud Reminders is a really great one because it's first party and it's simple. I still don't know of a way to easily do this using Google accounts.
Yeah, I'm not sure how you would do that either. Not with a list, at least. You'd probably just make a Google Doc and have bullets. That's probably what you'd do.
See, that's not good enough, though.
Yeah,
that's not good enough for me. I don't think it's. I think that Google really should have a first-party solution for shared lists that's not just a Google Doc.
So let's also move on, and we'll talk about some Mac address funniness that we mentioned earlier. You said we'd come back to it.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier. So iPhones and just about every other electronic device on a network has to use a MAC address to identify itself. And most of these devices up until now use a single address per network for the device for its life. And an artist in New Zealand has taken the tendency of Google Glass devices to do this, to transmit their own MAC address over Wi-Fi networks, to figure out a way to spoof the MAC address on that Wi-Fi network and therefore block it from communicating with the router. So if this software is on a device that's plugged into a network and someone with Google Glass connects to that network, they will be deauthorized from the network and won't have Wi-Fi anymore. So the guy figured out a way to automatically detect and disable Google Glass on a Wi-Fi network.
Yeah, so apparently the Google Glass MAC addresses have some kind of uniqueness to them. So you can just kind of analyze the MAC address and... and just block that whole class of MAC addresses, and then you've blocked all of Google Glass.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Well, but it doesn't block the class of MAC addresses. That's something you could do if you controlled the router. But what this does is, even if you don't control the router, as long as you're on the same Wi-Fi network, it can spoof the MAC address and then block it as it comes onto the network. So you can do it anywhere you are, not just at your house with your own router. Although that would be a good idea, too.
Yeah, you might as well just flip that on, right? That should be a plug-in for a router or something. That should be in the next build of DDWRT or something.
Okay, well, next week on our app pick, Chris will have written some software for that.
Yeah, unlikely.
So this is not an app pick that you are likely to use or see anytime soon, but I do think it will have long-reaching consequences for users of Google Glass moving forward, and I think we will start to see it more and more. And if you yourself are interested in blocking Google Glass on the places where you happen to go, I am sure that you will be able to build or buy these glass jammers very soon. So, and that's why it's the app pick of the week this week. Mostly just because I thought it was cool, and it is technically an app.
Yeah, that is cool. It's close enough. Close enough to it. Well, I'll give you that one, Taylor. So let's move on to our kicker. We've got some a interesting and controversial story. A maker of a supercomputer called Eugene, I suppose.
Eugene Goostman.
Yes, yes.
This supercomputer has two names that are designed to sound remarkably human-like is because the computer is designed to sound remarkably human-like. It was a supercomputer that was specifically designed to attempt to pass the Turing test, which is the test of can this computer fool actual humans into thinking that it's human. So what happened in the UK over the weekend is that this supercomputer was able to fool 33% of judges during 5-minute keyboard conversations. And that is according to the original stipulation of Alan Turing's mathematical test to be a minimum passing amount. Now, it's still 2/3 of people thought that this was a computer and not a person. But 1/3 of them were unable to distinguish it. And so the headlines on almost every article that you will read is that the Turing test was beaten and now we have supercomputers that can fool people. That's not entirely true.
Yeah,
but
that's not really correct.
The mathematical minimum limit for the test has been achieved. So science is making its way in fits and starts to attempting to create a computer that is indistinguishable in thought from a person.
Yeah,
and we've hit one small but not insignificant milestone in that scientific process.
They specifically made this computer program into a child so that they could kind of fudge the test a little bit. So since children aren't socially adapted to an adult's world, they sometimes, you know, they say crazy things sometimes. And them using a child specifically for this test means that they can kind of fudge the barrier a little bit. And I'm not sure, or at least that's a psychological explanation, but I'm not sure that they can claim that they even passed the test as long as they're using a child. I'm not sure that that is part of the criteria.
Well, it was modeled after a 13-year-old boy, and 2/3 of people thought that it was, in fact, a 13-year-old boy. It could have been a 5-year-old or an 8-year-old, and it probably would have been higher. But they could have fudged the test more, and I don't think that, I mean, in Alan Turing's time, a 13-year-old would have, for most practical purposes, been considered an adult.
Yeah, and Rennie brings up a good point, too. The other bit was that it's a non-English, or sorry, I should say, it's a English as a second language child.
Yes, absolutely. So the child was posing, or the computer was posing as a Ukrainian child speaking English.
So there's just all kinds of little things like that just to kind of throw you off. I don't think it's purely on the... Rennie in the chat there says, yes, he's Ukrainian, right? So there's a lot of little things that are intentionally kind of misleading the point of the test. The point of the test is to be, I'm not sure, is to, you know, trick boundary cases like this. It's to honestly make a computer that can fool the judges.
Well, no one's done that yet, Chris. So, but somebody did this. That's why I think it's interesting.
What I think we have here is the most advanced chatbot that we've ever produced, but I'm not sure I'd go further than that.
Sure, absolutely. No, I wouldn't say it passes the Turing test in a real...
Also, do you remember Cleverbot?
Not particularly.
This was one from about 3 years ago, and if I remember right, that also passed the test. I forget what the catch was, though. There was some kind of catch. I forget exactly... But we've had programs like these that have been able to kind of go over that barrier. And this is just another example of them.
Well, but I think it's the best example that we've had so far.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah, we should go back and look at Cleverbot. I'm pretty sure there's even online implementations of Cleverbot.
I'm sure there is.
Yeah, so...
But for now, there's just Eugene Goostman and
okay.
me.
Yes, and you. And Eugene is going to join us next week on the podcast. We'll see how he can do. I don't think he'd do very well. So, Taylor, if somebody wanted to contact you over the internet in some way, how would they go about doing this?
They would first have to prove to me that they are, in fact, a person and not Eugene Goostman or some other clever bot. So that will be difficult because my standards are now very high.
Yes, you'll have to administer a 1,000-question test.
I'm afraid of some clever bot taking advantage to me. Yeah, so I'm going to need to spend at least 10 minutes in direct real-time conversation before I give you my Twitter handle, which is at TaylorPhone. Dang!
Yeah, you just gave yourself away. Well, it's been more than an hour, even though it's a one-way conversation with the listener who may be interested in that. So, all right, well, if you wanted to get at me, I am at Chris Hale Barnes, and I think it's time to get out of here, Taylor. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show, and of course you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THEND USR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts you can have a listen to. Entertainment 2.0. They'll have a lot of the Xbox news coming up in way more detail than we described on this show. You can also listen to Scene in HD, the movie podcast, and Home On. You can also send us some feedback. Our email is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us on Twitter. Together, we are at @theenduser. You can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Moore.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Chris, how do I know you've passed the Turing test?
I guess you don't.
How do you know I've passed the Turing test?
I definitely don't know that.
Oh boy. Now we're in a pickle.